Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gail Schimmel.
Hi, Fiona.
Hi, Gail. How has your writing week been?
Fiona, okay, so I want to follow up from what I said last week, which was I talked about making the time in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to add a realistic check to that before I get into my writing week, that this week I've missed two of my writing sessions in the morning because my day job felt so overwhelming mm-hmm. that I realized that if I wrote first, I was going to make myself more anxious. So I want to add to last week's of advice of making the time that sometimes you also have to let yourself off the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I have made the time to a large part, and when I haven't done it in the morning, I've tried to make a bit of time in the afternoon, and that's mostly been possible because I'm rereading, because I'm completely stuck on a book.
Okay.
I had 35,000 words, and literally it was 35,000 to the word,
mm-hmm.
I stopped, and I didn't know where it was going, and I didn't know how to carry on, and I didn't know how to get myself started, and I reread.
Mm-hmm.
And I reread slowly and interestingly, have added about 1,500 words as I've gone through that reread, just clarifying, cleaning up, that kind of thing. I just finished the reread this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Do I know exactly what's going to happen? I think maybe on the drive here, I figured something out, and I think maybe it involves deleting some chapters, and I'm not really good at that. So that's where I'm at. What about you?
Yeah, I'm also at a strange place with a book because I've been writing it for a year and I had this idea in my mind that this was really going to be my magnum opus. This was going to be my big book, my important book, etc. And I finished it. I set myself a goal of 80,000 words and I got there and the book was finished. And I suddenly realized that it's not actually the work of genius that I was shooting for. And then the question was, oh, well, that's not good enough. I'll just have to write it over again. But then I stopped and I told myself that not everything has to be your final word on a subject.
Okay.
It can just be a thing that you've written.
Yes.
And maybe a stepping stone in your career to something else.
Okay.
And just taking that pressure off myself of this doesn't have to be the great work. This doesn't have to be the breakthrough novel. It's just a novel. It's okay. You can make it better.
Yes.
Maybe you can't turn it into, you know, whatever, perfection, Booker Prize winner, but you certainly can make it better. And maybe that is just good enough for now.
Mm-hmm.
Just managing those expectations.
Someone who writes on writing, I want to say it's one of the Annes, Anne Patchett or Anne Lamott, mm-hmm. but I'm not actually sure, talks about how the book in your head mm-hmm. is always more perfect than the book on the page, that your book
right.
is perfect until you start writing it.
Right.
And whichever one of these Annes it is, writes the whole book in her head first, or she did when she started. She waitressed. I want to say it's Anne Patchett, who wrote a wonderful, wonderful book on writing called The Getaway Car. A thing on writing.
Mm-hmm.
And she waitressed when she first was writing, and she'd write in her head while she was waitressing, and she'd write the perfect book in her head.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment you reduce it to writing, it's not perfect anymore. And maybe that's what's happened to you.
Yes, yes. In my head, it was this transcendent book. And now that it's on the page, it's just another book. It's a hard realization. It's a difficult thing to swallow. But it's very interesting to me that, you know, people have written about this and talked about it.
Yeah. And maybe it's a time for a reader, you know, maybe it's reader feedback, which I'm also wondering if because I never get reader feedback during a book,
mm-hmm.
but I am considering giving this book to you to read.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if I'm ready for the feedback. That's actually the resistance. I'm a bit worried you're going to say, yes, in chapter 3, I knew exactly how all these characters were related to each other. And it's clear that's what's happened is da, 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 da. And then I'm going to have to rethink the whole book. So I'm not sure I'm ready for that.
Oh boy. Yeah. We've talked before about how I'm willing to slash and burn my own manuscripts and just cut thousands of words at a time. And you are
really not happy to do that.
I'm
really not a slasher and burner. And I think it's because I'm lazy. And I've talked about laziness is my superpower, but sometimes it is a problem that, you know, cutting 10,000 words that you spend time writing, that goes against the lazy writer's guide of life. We'll see. I'll see where I go from here. It might be that you get an email from me this week.
I would actually love that, just for the record. But speaking of perfect books, what have you been consuming lately?
So I want to talk about a book, and we know that this didn't work out well for me last time I did it, but a book I'm currently reading. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk more about the reading experience. So I'm reading God of the Woods by Liz Moore, which is a book everyone's talking about, everyone's read, everyone's loved, and I have been assured by a trusted reading friend that I will love it. Mm-hmm. And I am enjoying it. But I'm finding it very slow. And I think it's because I'm reading it as a real book and not a Kindle book.
Right.
And I do most of my reading on Kindle mm-hmm. for several reasons. The biggest one being cost of books. They mm-hmm. are much cheaper on Kindle. Mm-hmm. The other one being ease of transport. If you go on holiday, you can take a Kindle, not a suitcase. But for all those reasons, and also I enjoy the Kindle reading experience. And I'm wondering, I can tell that the book is not fast-paced. It's a literary thriller, mm-hmm. which is always slightly slower paced than a non-literary thriller. In fact, I think that's what the word literary and thriller means, like that we will take you there slower, that we will pause and admire the scenery as we get you to the high-paced drama. But I don't know if it's the book. I don't know if it's me. And I'm wondering if you've experienced anything like this with your reading.
I have also transitioned almost completely over to Kindle now. I like being able to increase the font and see what I'm reading.
Tell us you're over 40 without telling us you're over 40.
Indeed. And ever since they created a new feature where when the Kindle's off, you can see the cover, that has helped me sort of distinguish one book from another, because yes. they were becoming a bit of a blur of text with one book running into another without that reminder of what the cover looks
so
like.
So my Kindle was doing that and it stopped doing that. Now it advertises to me when it's off.
Oh, maybe that's a setting that you can change.
Yes, I need to investigate that because it bothers me, but we're getting sidetracked.
No, I like Kindle. It's my favored way to consume a book. Going back to paper books is a struggle for me. It's like an extra obstacle to overcome. It doesn't sound as though that is the entire problem that you're having with this book.
Mm.
Maybe it is just a bit too slow-paced and
a bit too literary for me.
Yeah, or maybe up its own bottom with the literariness. I don't know.
Maybe I'm just not a literary reader anymore. And what about you, Fiona? What are you reading or consuming?
Also in the literary space, I realized that a big gap in my reading was Elizabeth Strout, that I'd never read the Lucy Barton books. Mm. I'd never read the Olive Kitteridge books. So I got advice from people who are fans of hers and read My Name is Lucy Barton. And then I read Olive Kitteridge that she won the Pulitzer for. And I have to say, yes, I get it, 100% get it. I'm hungry for more books by her. I love them. And Olive Kitteridge being the unlikable character, I loved more. I don't know why. I'm very interested in unlikable female characters at the moment. And Lucy Barton is quite likable, so you can relate to her. Olive Kitteridge has some really bad moments where something gets in the way of you liking her. You can understand her, but she's difficult to like. And I just loved that. I just loved living in that difficult, contested kind of space where you're struggling with your relationship with the character. So absolute works of genius. Love them. I'm a convert.
And am I making something up, or am I remembering correctly that the latest book they meet?
Yes. Yes, indeed. I believe so. I haven't read them. I'm wondering if that's a lazy choice on her part to take her two favorite female characters and make them have a conversation.
I have heard it's magnificent.
Oh, okay. All right.
I have heard. I have read one or two and I like them, but not enough to like go into a deep dive, reread them all. And I find I'm very scared of Lucy Barton's backstory.
Yes, yes.
But apparently it never comes and hurts you.
Okay.
But I'm very scared of it. So I'm scared of reading more because I'm scared of finding out more.
Well, an author who writes some likable and indeed lovable characters is our guest today. Our guest today is Penny Hall. Penny is the author of two children's books, Nico and With Love, Jen. She's also the author of The Wilderness Between Us, The Invincible Miss Cust, and The Woman at the Wheel. And coming up for us, it's next month. Maybe by the time this podcast has been released, the book will already be available. A new book called Follow Me to Africa, The Story of Mary Leakey. Penny, thank you for your time and welcome.
Thanks very much. It's really lovely to be with you, Gail and Fiona. It's a great privilege.
Penny, you know what we're going to ask because you listen to this podcast. How was your writing week?
Well, I've actually had a good writing week. It's actually been an editing week. I've spent the last 6 weeks, in fact, I looked yesterday because I was thinking, I feel like I've been doing this forever. I've spent the last 6 weeks revising my next book, the one that comes out in 2026. And it has been the hardest book I've written. It's another work of historical fiction. It's about Caroline Herschel, who was the first paid woman astronomer. She was actually German and she lived in Britain in the 1780s. And she was a paid astronomer. She worked as an assistant to her brother initially, and then worked on her own as a paid astronomer for King George III. And the book, it's just been an extremely difficult book to write. And it's been very interesting because I've realized that it's more about the character than the story. It's taken me a very long time to get to know Caroline. The characters of my other historical fiction, Aileen Cust, the first woman veterinary surgeon, Bertha Benz, the wife of Carl Benz, and Mary Leakey, the one that's coming out in February. They were women that I really related to. And Caroline Herschel has been extremely difficult. It's taken so long to get to know her. And so my editor had my first draft and it came back with plenty of revisions. And that's what I've been working on. But this week I have seen the light at the end of the tunnel, I hope, because one never knows, does one? But I feel as if it's been a hard 6 weeks. And as I say, yesterday I was thinking about it and I thought it's like tending a garden when you're editing something and you're revising, you know, you weed and you prune and you plant things. And then yesterday suddenly I thought I can see it now. So I'm hoping, as I say, one never knows, but I'm hoping that I've overcome something. But that's where my week's been. It's been a good week, but it's been an editing week.
I'm quite interested because we've never talked in depth about what goes into that editing work. You know, we say editing like everyone must know what we mean. And I know it's different for different people and different editors and how you get. What do you get back from your editor and how do you attack it? Like I know I get notes and I get on the manuscript comments and then I've got a process of how I attack that. What's it like for you?
Yeah, it's similar. I get an overall editorial letter, which is hopefully mostly positive, but which is, especially with the first, obviously the developmental edits, telling me where the plot slows down, maybe where the character's lacking, where I might have lost readers' attention because I've gone into too much detail. And I guess the first edit, this one that I'm working from, is that very much the developmental one. And because it's been a difficult book, it's actually the first real overhaul of a book that I experienced. And I'm working with a new editor. My editor on the previous three historical fictions has left the company, and I have a new editor, which is always scary when you've worked with someone and then you work with someone new. But I'm very happy with her edits. I mean, she's been fabulous in directing me without directing me. You know, kind of, I guess, showing me where she sees the problems are. It's this one has been big, and it's required all these weeks. And I've been at my desk. Unfortunately, the edits came back 2 weeks before Christmas, so I've kind of been at my desk all the way through, you know, with some days off here and there. But it's been tough, but it's a good learning experience.
And how do you personally respond to the editing process? Do you become defensive, or do you embrace correction? Do you take well to it? How do you respond emotionally to an editor's input?
I guess the first thing is, oh no, that's the first response. But I had an inkling that this book was not where it should be. So, to be honest, I wasn't surprised with this particular one. And my husband reminded me the other day when I was complaining, obviously. He said to me, he said, remember you always said, well, long before I was published, I said, I can't wait to work with an editor who would really challenge me. And that you learn as you go along and you work together, and that's really what the process has been. So it's been a bit of a case of beware of what you wish for. But for this particular one, I was not surprised. I'm actually not that defensive, and I think it's something that I've learned from having been a writer my whole life. You know, working as a journalist and a columnist, I learned the value of good editors. I mean, I don't know about you two, but having a good editor is just the most wonderful thing. I always think it's such a privilege. So I'm not defensive, but I will defend things that I think that I kind of strongly believe should not be changed. And obviously editors also miss things. You know, editors will do things like say, don't you think you should explain this a bit more? And then you read a paragraph ahead and you think, you didn't quite see that it was all explained there. And then I will defend things, but I'm not, my default emotion is not defensive. I'm boringly compliant, probably.
I like that description because I think it describes me as well, that I'm an unexpectedly compliant person. Boringly compliant is going to be my new hat. Before we leave process, tell us what it looks like when you're writing a book. We'll talk a lot about your ideas. I know both of us are interested in where the ideas come from. But when you're in the thick of writing, how many words a day, morning, evening?
I'm a very, dare I use it again, boringly businesslike writer. And it's another hangover from working as a journalist. You know, working as a predominantly freelance journalist in the last 10 years of my life was a case of, if you aren't at your desk producing articles, you're not going to send any invoices out. So I'm very disciplined about getting to my desk. I love my office. This is not my office because my office has got very high ceilings, and I did thought the echo would be awful, but I love my office. It's my favorite place in the house. And I keep business hours, actually, although I do first of all go for a run, walk the dog, so my business hours are not quite 8 till 5. But I love being in my office. I love working. I love feeling productive. So I'm not someone who sits around waiting for the muse. I I probably, if you ask me where I wanted to be, I want to be somewhere writing. So it's my first choice. And how many words a day? It really depends. It depends on where the story is, which story it is. And each of my books has been quite different. I know that with, for example, the first historical fiction about Aileen Cust, the veterinary surgeon, just it kind of just flowed out of me. And every evening I'd come downstairs and bore my family to tears, telling them about what I'd written and how amazing this woman was. And actually, they say to me now, "You never talk about your books anymore." I guess I think, well, you've heard enough. But with a story like that, I it really just it was so wonderful to write. I just couldn't wait to write it. I mean, her life was so extraordinary. So it's hard to say how many words a day, but my hours are definitely there. And if I can keep myself away from social media, because that is a terrible thing, I tell myself I need to be there because one has to do all this promotion and what have you, but man, it is distracting. It is terribly distracting. And I'm definitely among those people who's become a bit addicted to it. And that it's I almost reward myself sometimes when I'm pressing a deadline. I go, okay, if you don't look at it for 3 hours, then you can have 15. It's like
Three
an incentive.
hours. 3 hours.
I'm
I
not saying
could
it
never.
happens. I tried to tell myself, but yeah, it's a very distracting thing. I just think I'm the luckiest person because I just love writing and even the editing. I mean, I sound like I was complaining about it earlier, but I love that feeling of facing a challenge and seeing it work. It really fills me with joy.
Well, I know Gail and I are both very interested in your journey to publication. And as a journalist, you seem to have always connected your writing to the real world. And when I look back on your career as a writer, it seems even your children's books were inspired by real events. And then your first adult novel, The Wilderness Between Us, was at least inspired by a walk that you yourself took through Tsitsikamma. Was that always what drew you, writing from real events, or have you ever been drawn to the entirely fictional? Just give us an idea of your journey towards publication.
That's a very interesting question because my first experiences of storytelling were talking to myself as a child. I grew up on a farm and I was the youngest and the only girl. I spent a lot of time on my own. I loved it. I walked around and I told myself these amazing stories out loud. I pretended I was talking to the dogs, but I was really talking to myself. And I told these fantastical stories where obviously I was the hero. At some point I was Susan the lawyer, which still surprises me because unlike you, Gail, I there was no there was there was no legal connection in my family. I come from a family of farmers, and but somehow I learned what a lawyer was, and I was going to be Susan the lawyer, and then after that I was Penny the vet. And the stories, I guess they were based in situate set in an environment that I understood, definitely the vet anyway, because it was on a farm and I loved animals, but they were pure fiction. And then I had such joy telling myself those stories. I mean, it was like radio theater for me. I couldn't wait to get up and go out and go walking and create these stories and tell my dogs the story. And they were episodes. So one day this would happen and the next day that would happen. But they were pure fiction. And then when I became a journalist, I kind of lost that playfulness of imagine the imagine imaginary part of storytelling. And I always wanted to write a book. I always thought I would. And at some stage, my son had obviously heard me saying this too often, and he said, "Well, just do it, you know." And I realized I was terrified of the idea. Somehow you get comfortable with what you know. The idea of long form makes you feel quite vulnerable. It puts you in a different space. You're exposed. I think as an author, you feel more exposed than you do as a journalist. Maybe as a journalist, you're telling other people's stories, and as an author, you're exposing more of yourself. So I was quite nervous of it. And my son actually said to me, "Why don't you write a children's book about Nico?" Which is, as you said, Fiona, that's based on truth. It's a story about a vervet monkey that my grandmother raised, and I'd grown up with stories about Nico, and I heard them in my grandmother's voice, and I wrote the book as if she was talking to me, and I always think of it as my gateway book, but it was based on truth, and but it did make me realize how much of the playfulness of writing that I was missing. And I really loved the process. In fact, I wrote it only after hours because I felt so guilty about the joy that the writing was giving me that I thought it wasn't work. So, you know, I had to, and at that stage, I was still working. But I wrote it only on weekends and after hours because it felt like it was too pleasurable to be work. Very strange, I know, but that's just the way it
No, I
is.
love it. I love it.
I absolutely loved that, and when Nico was published, a man in here in Hout Bay where I lived was starting a writers group. He's an author, and he was looking for some people to join his writers group. And he somehow found out about me, and he asked me if I'd like to join. And I actually, at that point, hadn't thought that I'd carry on writing fiction. I mean, it was just something that I'd done for fun, and I joined the writing group and. With that particular writing group, we were each working on our own projects, preferably a novel, and we would meet twice a month and take turns in workshopping each other's work, you know, a chapter of each other's work. And so that's kind of how I continued writing fiction. And your question was based in the truth. And in fact, the first adult novel that I wrote has never been published, and it was also based on something that I experienced. I had a bicycle accident when I was 23, 20, yeah, about 23, and I was unconscious for about a month. I lost about a month of my life. I fell on my head, and I was out of it. And when I came to, I had no memory of the accident. I remembered moments leading up to falling off, but I had no memory of the accident. I had no memory of being in hospital or of anything. So essentially, I'd lost a month of my life. And so the first novel that I wrote, I explored that experience, what it was like, what it could be like, not my experience of it, but what it could be like if you had an accident and people that knew you didn't find or you found yourself somewhere else or whatever. So I guess so that book was the book that got me my first literary agent, but it was never acquired by a publisher, so that one sits quietly somewhere. And then I guess it's just that nugget of something that I've experienced, like the Tsetse Karma. I had done the hike. The Wilderness Between Us also explores the anorexia, which I experienced as a teenager and young 20-year-old. And I guess it's just things that I feel I understand a little bit, or maybe I want to explore in myself. But yeah, so there's definitely an element of truth there, and certainly the settings and the animals are things because I love the outdoors and I love animals. So those things just bring me such joy to write about. I feel like I can't actually write a book without there being some animals and without there being some lovely settings outdoors. That's just who I am.
It feels to me when I, as I've kind of followed your journey, reading as you've grown as a writer and looking back at it, it feels like you were looking for your exactly happy writing place, and now you have found it in the historical fiction. And I mean, I'm the biggest fan of I can never remember what it's called, The Wilderness Between Us. I've just looked at Fiona's notes. I can picture the cover perfectly, but can I remember the title? No. I'm a huge fan of that book. I love the ending of that book. But when we get to your historical fiction, it's like you've really found your voice. Is that a true reflection? And how did you get there? How did you come to the historical fiction?
Well, actually, it was never my plan, so it was a surprise. And in retrospect, I think, well, how did I not see it? Because I loved history at school. It was a go-to subject for me, and certainly I've always been interested in history. But I hadn't planned to write historical fiction. And what happened there was, after I'd written The Wilderness Between Us, I was thinking about writing something that was set in a veterinary practice, maybe somewhere in the country. And I was brainstorming with my daughter-in-law, in fact, and she's a fabulous young feminist, and she's full of great ideas. So I just love chatting to her about these kind of things. And we were talking about maybe settings, having a woman veterinary surgeon who, and exploring the patriarchy and the sexism that she would probably come up against, particularly in a rural setting and what have you. And I thought, yeah, that's really a great idea. And I googled, when did women first become veterinary surgeons? And that was when I came across Aileen Cust. And it was extraordinary, because within half an hour, I thought, well, this woman's story must be everywhere. There must be historical fiction about her anyway. It was just the most amazing thing. And when I discovered that nobody had written her story aside from a small biography by a fellow veterinary surgeon in Britain, I thought, well, this is the story that I've been looking for. So I actually didn't set out to write historical fiction, but it took off from there. And as I say, in retrospect, I think, how did I not see it? Because I love the voices, I love the research that is required. It feels quite natural to me. On the other hand, I don't think that I won't write contemporary fiction in the future at some stage. I would love to do that again. And the other thing, obviously, is that once the Invincible Miss Cust was picked up by Sourcebooks, my agent said, well, if they're interested in one book, let's try and make it a multi-book deal. So it means that you've got something to work towards. You're not always trying to sell every book on its own. And because I was an unknown author, it needed to be something in that same genre. So that was where I had to set out for the next book, which was the book about Bertha Benz, and then the following deal, which was another two biographical historical fiction about the same kind of topic, women who have done extraordinary things. It was kind of by mistake, but as I say now, when I look back on it, I think, well, how did I not see it coming?
Well, it was a very happy accident. Now,
Yeah.
the two that I've read, the Aileen Cust and the Bertha Benz books, are written in the
Yes.
first person. So you inhabit that character, their inner life, telling their story as though they're telling it themselves. So for that level of intimacy, you have to know the character really well and feel comfortable inhabiting the character. Can you take us through your research process and what it takes to get to know a character that intimately?
The nice thing about both Aileen Cust and Bertha Benz, or the positive thing for me to write it in the first person, was that there isn't a lot of their own writing around. So there wasn't already a voice for them out there. It didn't feel as if I was assuming that I could take on their personalities. I guess because it's fiction, one does make a lot of assumptions. Aileen Cust, there were a few copies of speeches that she'd made later in her life that I could read. There wasn't, but there are no autobiographies written by either of them. Bertha Benz, obviously Bertha spoke German. She wasn't even English, so that was already a separation. So the assumption, and I mean, it's a question that people ask, what gives you the right to assume you know how what these women thought and what have you? Well, I don't know what they thought, but I'm celebrating them, and I like to imagine that I know what they thought and what might have been said and what they might have felt in certain circumstances. I mean, as an author, you're always going to be there no matter how much you want to step back, and particularly where you're writing in the first person. And the amount of research, well, it's I did as much as I possibly could. Neither Bertha nor Aileen, as I say, there was not a lot written about either of them. The biography about Aileen that was written by Connie, so forgetting your surname now, was very much about the legal problems that Aileen Cust had getting registered by the Professional Association. There was not a lot about her personal life, so I had to dig a bit deeper. For the most amazing thing was that she was a good friend of Dorothy Gray, who was Edward Gray, the foreign secretary. British Foreign Secretary's wife. So there was quite a lot of kind of secondhand information around that friendship. But it's an interesting thing there, assuming one taking the voice. But it just for me it just I related so closely to those women. It was possible. And I wanted to make their stories really personal. And then the Follow Me to Africa, you'll see I haven't written in the first person because Mary Leakey has her own autobiographies out. Mary Leakey has written extensively. Aside from her academic papers, she has a beautiful autobiography. Her voice is very clear. If you're interested, you can read it wherever. So I stepped away and I wrote it in the third person. And Follow Me to Africa is quite different because it's a dual timeline story, because partly because Mary Leakey already has her own autobiography and, as I say, a lot of academic papers. So I stepped away from telling the story from her perspective. I felt like I couldn't assume her voice because her voice is already out there. So that story is quite different from the other two. And the one that I'm writing now, the Caroline Herschel one, is again in first person. And maybe when you were saying that, Fiona, about how you kind of had, how you need to know your characters very closely, and maybe that's been part of my problem here, is that I've had such difficulty getting to know Caroline Herschel and relating to her. So that's where the difficulty has been.
Very interesting. And obviously the research is not just into the woman, but you're writing in a different time. So you have to get the details of that time right, which is the thing that frightens me the most after having written 5 pages of a conversation on a cell phone in a book set in the 70s as my first book. I don't even know how you begin to go back further. How do you go about that? The details of the surroundings, the place, the time, all of those things.
I mean, we live in a wonderful age of Google, don't we? I mean, it really is. I don't know how anyone wrote this kind of fiction before the internet was available. In fact, I've been with the book that I'm working on now. It's set initially in Bath and at the time that Jane Austen was writing. So I've been rereading Jane Austen. I've been rereading and re-listening to a lot of Jane Austen, and yeah, the research. I mean, it's actually never ends, to be honest. People say to you, "Oh, do you do your research and then you write the story?" In fact, it never ends. Every time you go back and you're doing some editing, you go, "Well, I better check this." I mean, for example, something so simple. Yesterday I was looking and I saw that I'd used the word hello, and hello didn't come into being in that particular era. Hello was first used when the telephone came into being, and I'm writing about the 1780s, and that kind of thing. So there are all these things that you just write, and then you discover, well, actually, no, that wouldn't be appropriate. I also am very lucky to have copy editors who do the historical checks for me, and I've learned so much from them. The Aileen Cust, for example, I described this outfit that her mother was wearing, and my editor pointed out, well, they didn't the sleeves would not be like that, and it was just so wonderful, and it made me aware. So every time I describe an outfit, I've got to go and check up, oh, what were they wearing? Would it be, what kind of fur stole would it be? What kind of sleeves? What kind of bodice? What? And so I've learnt as I go along, and but it is never ending, and I'm sure that readers will tell me when I get it wrong, because it'll happen.
I'm interested to know what your happy place is when you're writing historical fiction. Do you like it when you've got these factual guardrails of what really happened to work within, or are you happiest when you're occupying the imaginative space where there isn't really anything known and you're having to make stuff up essentially?
Yeah, definitely the latter. I love I think one of the most enjoyable parts of writing The Invincible Miss Cust was the romance that she had with Dr. Willie Byrne. And there was it is known that they had a relationship, but how it happened and the extent of it were not known. And I was so excited about giving her some joy in her life after all the difficulties that she had to endure with her family and the law and the church and everything, that I absolutely loved imagining the joy that she could have had in this romance with the other vet. I think that's definitely the joy. I love writing the animal scenes, and in the Follow Me to Africa, one of the things that drew me to Mary Leakey was what an animal lover she was. She was a breeder of Dalmatian dogs, and she always had dogs around her on the archaeological sites. I loved that. And there's actually a cheetah in it, which is also based in truth. So when it comes to writing about the animals, I'm always like, yay, this is the scene with some dogs and the cheetah or a visit to the Ngorongoro crater or whatever. That's definitely a happy place, writing about the bush and about animals and about the joy that humans get from animals, actually. The companionship, the pleasure that animals give them, and I guess that's why I choose the characters I do.
Penny, I want to go back a little bit into the publishing journey because you're not a South African author in a sense. You are an international author. Fiona and I made ourselves quite jealous looking at how many reviews you've got on Goodreads. Had a little moment of feeling inadequate and bitter, but we got over that. You've done it the international way, and I think you've been very lucky in that you've done it internationally, but you have local recognition. But was that always your intention? Did you set out and go, if I'm doing this, I'm doing this all over the world. I'm not just going to be published in South Africa, or did you just fall into that?
I didn't do it intentionally. I actually, it was Bridget Impey from Jacana who put me on the route. I wanted. I guess I didn't really know anything or know a lot about how it might work. Nikko was published locally by Penguin Random House, and I was so naive at that point. I actually imagined that that if one was published locally, then obviously the book would just be available everywhere. And when I was looking for a publisher for the story I wrote about the one based on the head injury, I went to the Pitch to Publishing initiative, which Bridget Impey and her colleagues at Jacana used to have, and I pitched the idea there, and Bridget said to me, you should try and find an agent, find an international agent, because this kind of writing will do better. And I don't know if she was just being kind and trying to get rid of me, but she just so I thought, well, okay, if that's what I should do, then I'll do it. And that was what I did. And I went into what you'll know as the query trenches, and I took all the rejection, and I went through weeks and weeks of submissions, and but I you know it was such an interesting process. And I think because I'm someone who has just been raised to, if you want to do something and someone says no, just see if you can prove them wrong. So I endured that, and when I found a literary agent in the US, I thought, oh, it's, this is where we go. But then that she was very excited. That was, as I say, the book about it was actually set in the Unkomas in KwaZulu-Natal, based on the with a story about the head injury. And she was very excited about it, and I thought, oh, this is going to happen for me, and it didn't. And in the interim, I came across the story about Aileen Cust, because obviously the thing is that when you're on submission, you shouldn't focus on the book that's on submission. You should be working on the next one. And the agent didn't like my idea of the Invincible Miss Cust, and so she and I went our separate ways. She said the story was too quiet. She didn't think that she couldn't see a market for it, and so I was without an agent again. And then I thought, oh, now I have to start all over again. So the book that I'd signed her with didn't sell, and I was kind of back to square one. And the publishing house, Source Books, they're based in Chicago, and they're a woman-owned publishing company. They were until very recently known as the largest independent publishing company in the US, but they're subsequently Penguin has got majority shares in the company, but it's still run by this extraordinary publisher called Dominique Rucker. She's got a largely women executives. They're just the most extraordinary company, and they had taken the manuscript of the book that had been out to acquisition. So I knew about them from my former agent, and I'd been very excited. I thought they might acquire it, and then whatever happened, they didn't. They decided not to do it. But while I was querying the Invincible Miss Cust, I saw that one of the editors had an open window for historical fiction about women, who unknown women, and I wrote to her, and I said to her, would you be interested in seeing this? And she said, yeah, sure. And so I sent it to her, and 3 months later, you kind of almost forget, because you think, well, obviously not interested. I woke up one morning. It's nice thing about working with Americans. You get the news first thing in the morning, yeah. And she said, we'd like to make an offer. And but they like to work through a literary agent because that's the way their business models are set up. So she said to me, I can tell you that we're going to make an offer, but we'd like to work through a literary agent. So would you like to go back to your other literary agent, or will you try and find someone else? And I felt that since the other literary agent and I had kind of parted ways, I needed to find someone new, especially now since now I was looking at historical fiction, different agents and different that look at different genres. So I was able to find an agent with an offer in hand, which is really a great privilege because then I could kind of be a little bit choosy. So, so I was really lucky, and I could go to an agent who I thought, oh, this would be great, and say to her, listen, this is what's happened. Here's the offer. Would you like to represent me on it? And any further books. And so that was how I signed with Jill Marzel of Lions, Marzel Lions. And
You just went straight for the big guns there.
no, it was really fortunate. I mean, but it just shows that, there's so many different ways to getting published, but they all require perseverance, I think, but a staying power, hey? I mean, you guys will know. So yeah, that was how I became internationally published, maybe because just from being rejected by local publishers.
Well, it was their loss, clearly. Penny,
Thank you,
I'm so
Fiona.
interested in why you've been struggling with the manuscript you're working on now. And you talk about yourself and your editor struggling to connect with this character. Is there an element of unlikability about her? Is that the issue? Because unlikable female characters are an obsession of mine.
It's so interesting, because there is. They
Okay.
she yes, and it was one of the problems. Liv, my editor, said to me, she's so mean. And she part of the problem with her was that she was very beholden to her brother. So in some ways she was passive, too passive. She the backstory there was she was born in Hanover, which was part of Germany, and she suffered from smallpox and from typhus. So she was very badly scarred, and she was her growth was stunted. She was a very tiny, scarred woman, and her mother decided that she wasn't worth an education. So the rest of the siblings were all educated, but Caroline, it was decided that it wasn't worth spending money on an education for her because she would never attract a husband anyway. I'm not quite sure how that worked, but anyway, I guess at the time it's like you just didn't know. And so she'd essentially become the family servant. And one of her brothers, William, went to England to work as a musician. He actually avoided conscription. At that point, the Prussians were fighting the French, and he hopped across to England to avoid conscription. And he was a musician, and he, for some reason, he was someone who cared about his younger sister. He was the only one in the large family that really seemed to care about her. And he came back to Hanover, and he had found a job in Bath as the musical director of public concerts. So he was a great musician and had an orchestra and was a music teacher. And he convinced his mother that he could take his sister, Caroline, to England and teach her to become a useful soprano. Now, she had no education or anything, and the mother was very against it because she was losing a servant. So he had to pay their mother the cost of a servant for another few years in order to take the sister. I mean, how awful is the story? But anyway, so he essentially rescued his sister. She was age 22. He took her to England. She had barely any education, and he taught her music. But at the same time, he had begun to get interested in astronomy, and a very he was a very clever, resourceful man, and he taught her to become a soprano, and she sang with his concerts, so she was useful to him. And the deal with her mother was, as long as she was useful to William in England, she didn't have to go back to Hanover. So she was going to be useful to William, and she was so beholden to him for essentially rescuing her and giving her a life of purpose as a singer, that her memoirs and papers written about her make her this woman who just can never own her own brilliance, because she was pretty brilliant too. And it's a frustrating part of it. And the meanness of her was that she was very possessive about her brother. And the big I'm getting all the spoilers here, but the big breakup was when he, at the age of 50, he fell in love for the first time, and he married, and it absolutely destroyed his sister. I mean, she was 12 years younger than him, and but she was quite embittered, and so those were the problems with her. She's very passive, and she was just beholden to her brother, that it made, I mean, it was so difficult for me to, I guess, to understand why she wouldn't why she wouldn't just own her intelligence and her power, because she did have power, but she was she was self-effacing. And so I've had to work through all of that. And she was and she was unlikable, because she was she in a way she was obsessed with her brother, and wouldn't allow anyone else close to him. And I guess that's part of the problem. And unlikable woman. I've been having this discussion with my husband a lot, and he's been saying, "But she sounds like a wet, unlikable woman." I'm going, "No, but she's not. She's not." And I'm still, as you can hear, I'm still battling to to say that, it's my underlying motivation with these stories is to celebrate these women. So that is important, but it's been the stumbling block of writing about her. And it certainly taught me, to maybe choose my main characters a little bit more carefully for future, because I'm not scared of hard work. But this book has not been as joyful to write as the others were. I'll admit that. It's
Well,
been harder work.
that actually leads to one of my questions, which is, how do you choose the characters? How do you like? Do you read a story and then have a like? I relate to this person. How do you choose them? Because there are lots of women who've been silenced by history.
Yes. Yeah. Well, as I explained earlier, the way Aileen Cust kind of fell into my lap, because I was looking at veterinary surgeons. And then Bertha Benz, the story of Bertha Benz, I had when I was working for Business Day, we were doing a supplement on for Women's Day, and we were looking at women in history, in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And I read a paragraph about Bertha Benz, and how her trip between Mannheim and Pforzheim had been the first long distance test drive, and how amazing it was. And when I read that paragraph, I thought, well, this is not just a woman who woke up one morning and decided that she was going to take her husband's noisy, smelly machine across 106 kilometers. She knew a lot more about it by then. So I knew about her from then. So when my agent and I were discussing pitching another idea to the publisher at the same time as the Aileen Cust story, I remembered Bertha, and so I thought that would be an interesting story. So that's how she came about. Mary Leakey, I had read her autobiography, and being quite fascinated by it. And what I tried to do in that story, I did, the question that you often hear in interviews is, what would you tell your 18-year-old self? What would you know, those kind of retrospective, reflective, what have you learned from the years of your life? And I, when I was reading the autobiography, I thought, well, she must have been such an interesting person to learn from, would make a wonderful mentor. And so that's actually where that the story, the idea came from. So the dual timeline, I've got a completely fictitious mentee who, when Mary Leakey is at the age of 70, is busy packing up her camp at Old Devi. A 17-year-old girl comes with her father for a 10-day stay, and the girl is battling with various things, and Mary Leakey, they connect, and Mary Leakey essentially tells her life story in a sense, and is a mentor to her. So that's how that story came about. And the Caroline Herschel story, in fact, I came across Caroline Herschel when I was researching Bertha Benz. And at the time, I wrote a bit about, I think there's just a paragraph or so in The Woman at the Wheel about Caroline Herschel. And my editor actually said to me, I would love to see this as a book, a story about Caroline Herschel. So that's actually where that one came about. And her story is fascinating, but yeah, the character has been the difficult part. But hopefully by the time the book is published, none of that will be obvious.
Well, we are really excited about your two upcoming books, the one coming next month and the one coming
Thank you.
next year. In the meantime, Penny, as you know, we love to ask authors what they have been reading or listening to or watching lately that's made an impression on them.
Okay. Yeah, I've been reading a lot of historical fiction, but I do love to read contemporary fiction as well. So, I mean, it's just like, so because the historical fiction can also feel like work when when you're reading something and you're kind of dissecting it as a writer rather than enjoying it as a reader. So I like to get away from that. I've just read an advanced copy of a book that's coming out in May. It's called Happy Is the One, and it's by an author, a British author called Katie Allen. It's a very the premise is fascinating. It's about a young man, he's in his 30s, who his name's Robin, that's right, Robin Banks, and he's born on the day that the Halley's Comet flies across the sky. And he hears about the story about Ernest Hemingway, who was also born then, and then said that he would die 76 years later when the comet came back. And this young man, for various reasons, decides that that's the trajectory of his life. And he manages everything in his life around the fact that at the age of 76, when Halley's Comet comes around, that is when he's going to die. And it's just a, it's a, it's a beautiful, uplifting story about how we actually can't manage what happens in our lives, no matter how hard we try. So that's really lovely. That's coming out in May. The other one, the historical fiction that I've just stopped finished listening to, is called The Trial of Mrs. Rylander, and it's about by Denny S. Bryce. A very interesting story about Alice Jones, who was accused of passing as a white in New York in the 1920s. She married a very wealthy young man. His name was Lenny Rylander, and his family were absolutely appalled, and they took her to court because they discovered that she was not white, and she'd never claimed to be white. I mean, she, but it's the story about the case, this this awful trial that happened in the 1920s in the US, but a very interesting story, and that's biographical historical fiction as well. I mean, it's one of these books, and that's what I kind of dream that hope that happens with some of my stories, that you discover these stories that are, that are so extraordinary. You think, did this really happen? And you have to Google it to see, well, actually, this really happened. I mean, and there are stories that many of us wouldn't come across if it hadn't been fictionalized to some degree. So that was a really lovely one. And next to my bed, I have In Other Stories, which is an anthology of flash fiction, which was published last year by Caravan Press. I don't know if you've seen it. But I absolutely loving those. I mean, they're a collection of these short pieces that, when you read when you haven't really got time to read a few chapters of the book that you're reading. So I've got that as well. What am I listening to? Oh, I'm listening to, I mentioned earlier that I've kind of been going back to the classics with the Jane Austens and what have you. I've actually been listening on Audible to some of Thomas Hardy, which I haven't since school, university days had listened to any Thomas Hardys and that, and I'm listening to The Return of the Native, which is read by Alan Rickman, which is absolutely beautiful. And it's reminding me how many things have changed and how many things have stayed the same in stories and in writing. It's lovely. What am I watching? I've been watching Shrinking on Apple TV. Don't know if you've seen that, but it's made by the same team that did Ted Lasso. Very uplifting, very interesting portrayal of a man with Parkinson's by Harrison Ford. Really enjoyed that. I think it's real escapism. And also Bad Sisters on Apple TV. I don't know if you've watched that, but yes. Some wonderful Irish women doing some amazing things. So yeah, that's what I've been listening to and watching and reading.
I'm sensing a bit of a tie-in between The Wilderness Between Us and the first series of Bad Sisters. But anyway,
Yes.
before we sign off, Penny, belated congratulations on winning the Phillida Literary Award in 2024 for your body of work, awarded to a mid-career writer for a distinguished body of work. So congrats on that. And we hope everyone checks out your backlist and, most importantly, that everyone buys Follow Me to Africa, which will be available in February of 2025. And we're looking forward to that and to the one after that. So thank you so much for your time, Penny. This has been delightful.
Thank you, Penny.
Thank you very much. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Gail, Penny Hoare has been on our wish list for a long time, and I'm so glad we got to speak to her.
You know, she's exactly what I needed today. I needed to speak to someone who's energized and excited by their writing. I needed to remind myself that writing is basically a joyful thing to be doing and a lucky thing to be doing, and I got that from Penny.
I also want to talk about the joy of writing aspect, but first of all, what did you get from what she said?
So I was so interested in the talk about editing. I'm so glad we had that. And she said something that fascinated me, that she loves the satisfaction of being faced with an editorial problem and then fixing it. And it's something I related to, and it's something actually I wanted to talk about in my advice. So I'm just going to do everything all at once. I had heard somewhere, because I never know where I hear things, that a good editor makes your heart sink slightly. And that has been my experience, that when you get those notes back and you're like, oh my God, that often is a sign that this is going to be a good edit. It's going to be an edit you needed, and it's going to be a very satisfying edit once you are through the hardness of doing it. And I think I was just interested that she recognizes that there's that satisfaction of You get an editorial problem that you actually, I've had this experience, you look at it and you think, I can't fix that. Like, it's too hard. It's going to untangle. We have this particularly with my Katie Gale writing, where I do most of the editing process, where fixing this little thing that the editor's highlighted is undoing a whole thread through the book. And you have to follow that thread back and fix the whole thread going through the book. And I'm not sure we always achieve that without leaving a little piece broken. But there is this huge satisfaction then of you finding the way you can fix it. And because I'm lazy, with the least possible work, and often the solution is so elegant, and there's a real satisfaction in that. So I think I love that she enjoys the editing process and finds satisfaction, and that's my advice, that the editing process can be very rewarding. Got all my thoughts into one go there. What about you, Fiona?
Well, as I said, I was interested in what she said about feeling so much joy in writing some of the books, especially the Aileen Cust books. And I think I think it's because she really related to that main character and found her very inspiring and likable. And she also talked about how, in her most recent work, the main character is less accessible to her and to the editor. There's that element of difficulty and unlikability. And I'm wondering whether that awkwardness won't lead to some of her most interesting writing to date.
It certainly sounded like a very interesting character to get to grips with, and she's done a terrible thing. I'm almost more excited about that book and then the book that's immediately available.
Yeah, so if I had to tie that to advice, it would be if you are really struggling with something in a book, perhaps that struggle process should not be shunned. Don't take it as a reason not to write that scene. It could be an indication that it's going to lead to your most interesting writing, that for the reader, that struggle on the page is going to be the most interesting thing to read.
Now, I don't know whether I must delete my chapters that I've written or not, because what if that's going to be the most interesting thing to read, Fiona? You are confusing me with your advice.
Send me that email, Gail. I'll look at it. So, in the meantime, we want everyone to check out Penny Hoare's books, especially Follow Me to Africa, which should be out by the time this podcast is out. And we'd love to hear if you've read Penny Hoare's books, if you have thoughts about what we've been chatting about. We're on all social media across the board, so please get in touch.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.